Good morning, Mrs. Ensor. It's very good of you indeed to receive us and talk to us about the new education fellowship. And like all good stories, I think we should begin with the children's phrase, once upon a time. Now, once upon a time, there was no new education fellowship, and then you brought it into being. Could you say something about why and how you did that?
Well, first of all, I think I must say that I don't want it to be thought that the fellowship is something that I, as a person, did, because it was everybody who helped to bring it about. And perhaps it is well to remember that there was an antecedent, so to speak, to the formation in 1921. I always think of it as having started in 1915. But I think that it is important to realize is that the fellowship was not a creative movement, that it didn't produce a new method of education, that its particular job was to collate and disseminate the different experiments going on in the world and evaluate them, test them in our laboratory schools, the new type of school, and then make of them a movement that was not sectarian or political or any particular technique or method, but a general new approach to education. And therefore one's got to remember the kind of opinion at that time, which was just after World War I, when everybody seemed to be thinking, could this have happened if education had been different? And then all over the world, apparently, experiments began to try to alter education, to alter the attitude of individuals towards the world. Because after all, society is composed of individuals. Individuals make a nation. Nations make the world. And therefore every individual attitude counts. The totality of their attitudes make aggression and war and all the other things that spoil society as it is. I think in a way it was very audacious of us to start an international movement. But I had been an inspector of schools for the county council. And then I was an inspector for the Board of Education. And though my subjects were special subjects, I naturally went in and out of schools and saw the type of teaching that was prevalent 55 years ago, which to me was completely wrong psychologically. Children being passive, being instructed instead of being active and learning by doing. Then suddenly, one day, I went to a Montessori school in Cheltenham. And there I found the children active, working in their own way, in their own interests, for as long or as short a time using material as they wished. And it struck me as something really very revolutionary. And at the same time, there was a movement started in England called Ideals in Education, New Ideals in Education, which was based very largely, do you remember Edmund Holmes's book, have you read it?
Yes.
What is and what might be in education. Well, he and a Mr. Lisa, a gypsy here at training college, started an association. And at the same time, a group of my friends who were theosophists in Letchworth began to talk about all this, the war, and the idea that if education had been different, it might not have happened. And as we believed that in every human being, now this is where you come in, there is, I will put it, a divine spark. You can call it life, you can call it God, you can call it soul, it doesn't matter. But there is something in that mysterious thing called life, which has enormous potentialities if given the right conditions and the right stimuli to develop or unfold. Is that how you would put it?
Well, I would put it exactly as you put it, and wouldn't presume to add anything to it except a footnote, which I think is interesting, because of course throughout the history of the New Education Fellowship, as I think you will agree, there has been this tension between, on the one hand, the non-religious humanist element, and on the other, the more, if you like, religious or spiritually centered kind of educationist. And this is sometimes, it seems to me, has been a positive thing, and sometimes it has been a negative thing, but perhaps today, and maybe later on we can talk about this, we seem to have got beyond both of those positions to a third position which seems to embrace the two.
Yes, well of course, though there is a within and a without, there's no real duality. The within cannot exist without the without, and the without cannot exist without the within.
Surely.
There's no duality. There can only be a oneness.
I quite agree with you. Well, now, I wonder whether we might pass on to another question. I wonder whether you would like to say something about any of the key figures in the early days of the movement with whom you had dealings. Anyone who comes to mind?
Well, yes, but I think I should say that at the Calais conference that the fraternity in education, as it was first called in 1915, came to the conclusion that if we wanted to expand and to draw in many teachers, we must not be an ism or an ist. It must be non-sectarian and non-political. And therefore, the secretary of the fraternity, whose name was Mr. Havlicek, an Austrian name, had the rather brilliant idea of calling a conference under the title New Education Fellowship, which has remained the title until the Chichester Conference in 68, was it?
Yes.
When it became the World Education Fellowship. And at that Calais conference, we decided on three things. First, to form an association called New Education Fellowship, and that it should be absolutely informal, that it should be quite different to ordinary organizations that had conferences with resolutions and motions and voting and all that sort of thing, that it should simply attract those teachers or others, because we wanted to draw in parents, social workers and so on, anybody connected with educating children who were in tune or in harmony with the aims of the fellowship. So we made a tremendous point of making fellowship the keynote. You see, luckily, I had been in a rather strategic position in the early days, because I was able to give my services free, because I was asked by the Theosophical Educational Trust to organize schools for them, so that I had laboratories, so to speak, in which to try out new methods. I was able to have an office free. I was able to have a secretary, and she turned out, Claire Soper, an extraordinarily good secretary for the New Education Fellowship, because she was dedicated to it, and she was very good at meeting people from overseas and so on. Well, the conferences were to be quite different from other kinds of conferences, not just in a big town and people lodged in hotels and going to meetings. They were to be in a beautiful spot. They were to last for a whole fortnight. There should be ample opportunity for teachers from different countries to meet, to dance together, to picnic together, to discuss together, and so on, to form groups, to discuss special aspects of education, and so on. And I think those conferences were extraordinarily interesting. At the same time, I had started, again, rather audaciously, a magazine called The New Era. And at the Cali conference, we decided that there should be three magazines: The New Era for English-speaking countries, edited by myself; Pour l'ère nouvelle, edited by Ferrière, Adolphe Ferrière, for the French-speaking countries; and a German magazine, edited by Elizabeth Rotten, for the German-speaking countries. So we already had a medium for communicating practically over the world. And at that Calais conference, I think there were about 14 countries represented, only about 100 people, and most of them were British people, of course. But it was extraordinary how the last conference that I attended, one of the last conferences at Nice, we had 1,800 people from 53 different countries. So that at every conference we got more attendance, more countries represented, and so on, showing how the fellowship had taken root practically in most countries. The personalities, you asked about personalities at Nice, were Elizabeth Rotten. She was born of German Swiss parents, and had a Swiss passport, which allowed her to come into France, because in 1921, just after the war, no Germans were allowed into France. And she was a tremendous pacifist. She was a great student of Goethe, and her philosophy was based on his teachings. But her main idea was pacifism. She wanted to prevent the children of the future going through what the children of 1914 had done. She'd seen it happening around her. And all along, that was her main interest in the New Education Fellowship. She was a remarkable woman, fluent in English, German, French, very humble. She never would take her place sitting on a platform. She would always sort of sit somewhere in a corner. And funnily, it always amused me because she seemed always to be writing innumerable postcards. Who she wrote to, I don't know. But all the time people were lecturing, she was writing postcards. And Adolphe Ferrière was another personality there. He was a social worker, very spiritual, an author. He was stone deaf and also suffered from diabetes. But he had been very much impressed with a reform movement in Germany among the boarding schools for a new type of education, and he had started a bureau of education to try and collect experiments in different countries. And it was always very amusing at conferences because he was terribly keen to hear what was being said, and I always had to sit next to him and translate and write out in French what was being said, or translate from the English into French and so on. And then we had Dr. De Croly of Belgium, who you know started the De Croly plan of education. And he was a very fine personality. So that we had Elizabeth Rotten, Ferrière, De Croly, myself, and a member of Parliament from England called Haydon Guest, later Lord Haydon Guest, who was very keen on this kind of thing. And we sat as a small committee and tried to work out the aims of the fellowship. Now, it was very difficult because we had to find phrases that were translatable into French and German as well as in English. And we wanted to show that there was what one may call not a sectarian but a spiritual background to the fellowship, that it was the hope of trying to get that inner side of the child that I have spoken about to be able to express itself absolutely freely. And in that way we hope that we might eventually perhaps change society by giving them a different attitude to life, cooperation instead of competition, self-expression at all levels of their nature, participation, it's now called, in the working of the school, and self-discipline instead of imposed discipline. And we worded these aims. They were very crudely worded from our point of view today because we've got far more psychological terms to use. For instance, there was one thing the supremacy of spirit over matter, which of course is ridiculous as looked at now, because as I said just now, there is no duality, there's only oneness. Spirit can't exist without matter, and matter can't exist without spirit. So, that was the Cadet Conference. Then I was able to travel a great deal, partly, for instance, I was engaged in bringing Hungarian children to England after the war. Well, when I went to Austria and Hungary to select those children, I made a point of seeing the schools and finding people who might be interested in starting groups of the fellowship. In Hungary, it was Madame Nemes, N-E-M-E-S, who started the Hungarian fellowship. In Bulgaria, it was Professor Katsarov who started it, and so on, in different countries. In Austria, there was a tremendous reform of education going on, and we managed to interest the two heads of the reform movement, Glöckl and another, I've forgotten his name. Then at the second conference at Montreux in 23, we met more very important personalities. I think the most important was Jung. We got in touch with Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst. He added the new psychology to these new methods that had been started, which gave a sort of background of philosophy of education to the new methods. And we met Delcroze, who showed us the self-expression in rhythm and movement and so on, rather than the stilted gymnastics of the time. We met Adler, another important person. And also it was at Montreux that we had the first member from the Progressive Education Association of the United States, which was a similar movement to our own in the States. And he invited me to go to the States. I couldn't at that time. But at the second conference, at Heidelberg, a lot of the progressive education people came, and then it was arranged that I should go to the States. And there, of course, I was thrilled to find that these new methods had been applied, chiefly, I think, based on the Dewey philosophy and brought into action by Kilpatrick as the project method, which meant that a child chose the particular thing it was interested in, and through his own interests and expressing those interests, he learnt the necessary skills. Oh, another very important person we met at Montreux, I think, was Chizik, the man, the artist from Vienna, who showed how if you allowed a child to draw and paint what he desired, you got the most remarkable results. And he gathered them on a Saturday morning and they came. There was plenty of paper and plenty of paint, and they just painted what they wanted. And putting that with the Jung idea, that there must be the complete flow of life through the trial. There mustn't be any blockages. One saw how by seeing what a trial painted, or even, I think it's called noodles, isn't it, if you write, how you can find out what is blocking, what fears are preventing the complete flow of life, so the child can manifest freely up to his capacity for doing so. As two examples, for instance, if you, would you like an example? I remember in one of our schools, there was one child who was always doodling sort of eyes, terrible eyes, fierce looking eyes. I thought there's something queer about this. So I tried to find out what it was. And it was that she'd been taught that God saw, was always looking to see everything she did. And she had this frightful fear that of God. And as I tried to get her right, gradually the eyes got softer and softer and entirely disappeared. Or there was a boy who I knew wasn't really able to express fully his intellectual capacity. I'm sure there was something wrong, I could see. So I tried to find out. He was a boarding school, and I used to sit on his bed at night and talk to him. And eventually I found that he'd been taught it was the devil. That the devil was always there, ready to tempt him. And it was blocking this flow of life. So you see that these doodles and these self-expression in art can reveal very often some blockage in the child which is preventing the full self-expression of its capacity. I think I've said enough about that.
Well, that's very, very interesting indeed and most helpful. Could I just ask one personal question there? I've often wondered, did we at any stage in the movement have much to do or little to do with Piaget?
Piaget. We met Piaget at Montreux and he was interested, but he didn't take as keen an interest as the others did.
And that was rather my impression.
But afterwards he did, more or less. And of course his books do represent very much what we believe in.
Quite.
And I didn't mention with Jung, which I think is rather interesting, is that we were the first association to offer him a platform in London.
Oh,
yes. We invited him, and I was in the chair, and H.G. Wells was there. I just knew H.G. Wells slightly, and he came up to me and he said, "Will you introduce me to you?" And I said, "Certainly." And then he asked us both back to supper at his flat. And it was so interesting to hear those two men discussing. I was fascinated. So that really the fellowship has given me more than I've given it, because it allowed me to travel, put me in touch to contact all sorts of interesting people. And I'm very grateful for the fellowship.
Well, we mustn't take up much more of your time, Mrs. Ensor. And in fact, you really have answered my next question, which was in which fields of education you thought the NEF had been most effective. You really answered that question.
Well, definitely primary.
Primary, yes.
The work of the fellowship now is to try and change secondary education, particularly if there's extension of education to 16. There's tremendous amount for the fellowship to do. The fellowship, to my mind, at the present is living too much in the past and not tackling the problems of today in education, which are just as serious as in the in 1921. This frightful examination question of this trying to pour knowledge into children in order that they may pass an A-level examination, get a good job and so on, is absolutely killing self-expression and individual responsibility and the teaching of new attitudes in world affairs and so on, don't you think?
Yes, I do indeed. Are there any particular lines that you would like to see the World Education Fellowship go forward on, other than those you just mentioned? You mentioned exams. Any other particular fields that you feel?
Well, of course, I personally have a very strong feeling that it's a shocking thing that England still believes in caning and using in Scotland, what is it they call it in Scotland? Yes. Other countries have banned it completely, and I cannot understand why English teachers at their associations defend it and say they can't do without it. Are English children worse than French children? More. Or are English teachers less able to keep discipline? What do you think?
I hope that was a rhetorical question. I'm sure it isn't the fact that we've just got an extra dose of original sin in this country.
Well, I think probably French children are more disciplined.
Possibly.
As a whole.
Possibly. Well, now I wonder whether any of the other people who are with us would like to ask Mrs. Ensor a question before we end the hearing.
I was wondering what you thought, did you think that the 11 plus, which is still widely used in this country, do you regard this in the same way as you regard O levels and A levels?
I think the 11 plus is a terrible examination because it tries to make a child decide far too early to specialize, what line to go on and what type of school to go to. And it's quite impossible at that age to know whether a child should go to a modern school or a grammar school or a sixth form in a primary school. I think it's an examination that should be absolutely got rid of as quickly as possible.
You would welcome, therefore, presumably the introduction of middle schools?
The introduction of
middle schools, a sort of transition between primary school
9 to 14, that sort of thing.
And secondary.
Yes, and I think that probably if they're in the comprehensive school, if that becomes general, if there's a sixth form in the comprehensive school, I would think it very important that at that stage, a child should partly work at school subjects and partly go out and do something in the world itself, so as to not be scholastically minded completely and then thrown into the world of industry. That they should be both scholastically taught to go on learning and at the same time be able to go into industry and find out the problems of industry and the need to take this question of industry sharing in management, as we try to show, that in, they have to share in school management.
Well, that's very much in line with the most progressive ideas today, and as I expected, 55 years ago and today, you're still telling us in what direction to advance, and we're very grateful to you.
Well, I think what's so amusing is to see that the things that we were saying 55 years ago are being said today by everybody. And the thing that amazed me, there is no question that the movement was started when the time was ripe, because it was extraordinary how all kinds of people, at first it was chiefly primary school teachers who belonged, and then suddenly it began to get people like Percy Nunn, who was a perfect dear, and others, Michael Sadler and Langevin in France, people of great intellectual ability and well known, coming into the fellowship. And it was extraordinary how it changed and how the training colleges got the idea. Teachers hadn't implemented the ideals of the fellowship fully, but at all events they're known and they're taught in training colleges, because after all the thing that matters is the teacher. The teacher, not the teacher who stood in front of a class with chalk and talk, but the teacher who is the guide, who can sit on the floor with children and guide them and lead them and bring out what is within them, give them the wider horizon. But it is the dedicated, I cannot stress too strongly that I believe just as much as I believed 55 years ago that teachers have it in them to help very largely to change society and to bring about world security. And I'm so interested to find that Bertrand Russell, in his latest book, and Aldous Huxley, in his latest book by his wife about him, The Timeless Moment, both say that education is the chief thing that can bring about world security and world peace.
Well, thank you very much. I think we should leave it at that then. And I really hope we haven't exhausted you.